Resources District. Thank you for coming, and who's going to lead us in the pledge? Director Fred?
Ready to begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, our nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Great. Ann, you want to go ahead and call the roll? Here.
Here.
Here. Here.
Here.
Here. Here. Excellent. Well, we'll go ahead and start with our annual recognition of staff longevity. There's some amongst us that have been here quite a time, so we're very excited to engage in that. And I think, Rich, you're going to lead most of those presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. At this time, I would like to recognize three staff members in no particular order for their time here spent with the district. And the first is our Administrative Services Manager, Rosa Rosales, for a whopping 5 years. So congratulations.
Yeah, that's
awesome. Now we're hitting the 10-year mark. And our next awardee here is Sean Boyle. And that concludes the, So lastly, I kid, is Anna Rourke, and she has been here 10 years as well.
Not quite all of them, right, Ann?
Yeah, I'm not going to go on and on because Rick will cry and nobody wants to. So. So Rich and I started almost the same time. He was had been here in February, and I came on in November, and he had 9 months to think about that he wanted to whatever thing he would have to do. So he was actually had to put me down the ground and pretty much just what he thought. Fine. But I just want to say a few things about this. This is not just a milestone to pass, because it's been, I can go on personally on and on, but I will make it general. No. I went on and on. So Rich consistently is looking for ways to increase the efficiency of this operation, and he's always open to ideas from others, both in and out of the district, office on how to always welcome to the technology. He really helped to push us out of where we were at the time into where we should be, and continue to do so. He's always welcome to anything new and fresh one in the things for the district. He always has the best interest of staff in mind. He's very concerned about well-being and environment. For example, he's a pretty good leader of staff. And he likes to make sure that things are going well. He's always looking out for the best interest. And it's just something that the public is constantly wanting to look out for that all the time. And that includes the board. He's always wanting to make sure the board is doing the best possible work. And I'm pretty sure that I'm going to have to do the mission. I could go on and on. But I will just say that this is
no speech. It's always nice to get recognition from my boss, so
Thank you, guys. I just want to say it has been, I'm going to be here 11 years in another month, so it takes a while to get these things processed. The same thing holds true for Sean. He's been here almost 11 years. 13? Oh, contractor. Okay. So thank you.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much, Ann, for assisting. Thank you, Rich. At this time, we'll go to public comment. Are there any members of the public that would like to comment on anything that's not on the agenda? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go on to just some quick reports. The Budget, Personnel, and Nominating Committee did meet. We received a report on our financial statements and the 2019 audit, and a clean audit, a good audit. You'll be hearing more about that shortly. We also took action and passed a motion to direct the APCO to deposit funds from the pension obligation pre-funding reserve into the pension fund rate stabilization program trust within the PARs. So just taking care of our obligations there. No other action to report at this time. Advisory committee, Rich?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. The advisory committee did meet on December 5th, and they received a presentation on Rule 441, which will be before you today. I should note that they did vote 7-1 to recommend adoption of the rule to the board. There was some misunderstanding on doing some accounting for ozone non-attainment with the rule. I should just remark that the rule has nothing to do with that. So one of the members felt they couldn't vote in the affirmative for the rule without additional information on our ozone inventory. This is something that's required by the state, has nothing to do with the inventory. So although it should help our emission inventory go down with respect to ozone. Also, the committee received a presentation on air quality tracks. That's the device we're presenting in schools. The board received this presentation a couple of months ago as well. So that was all we went over at the meeting.
Great. Any questions for Rich? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go on to comments and referrals from any of the board members. Yes, Director Hurst.
Thank you. I'd just like to go back to longevity for a minute because I'm a big fan of longevity. I remember when I got my 30-year pin from the Pajaro Valley School District, and there were a lot of people said I wouldn't last 30 minutes, let alone 30 years. And this is my, even with term limits, this is my 18th year on the city, Watsonville City Council. Nobody can figure that out either. So I'm a big fan of longevity, and congratulations to the staff. Many more.
Anybody else? I'll announce two things. This Sunday, there's still seats available for a holiday home lighting tour in Salinas. Buses starting at Kmart at 5:30. I'll put some flyers in the back if anybody wants to roll. We hit all four corners of the city. We stop at Girl Scouts, East Salinas, cookie decorating, grocery mall with a choral group, and then a rest home in South Salinas that'll have some food as well. So. And I'm having a... might be the future Trader Joe's in Salinas, that's right. Big move to the valley. So, anyhow, just thank everybody. Very happy holiday. Okay, Rich, your report?
Yes, thanks again, Chair, members of the board. I'm honored, and it's my distinct pleasure to introduce one of our newest employees, and that's Laura Sent, who's going to stand. Laura started with us on December 9th, and she's our newest senior fiscal assistant. She came to us from the city of San Juan Bautista, where she was an office assistant and the elected city clerk. Previously, she was with the County of Humboldt in their accounting department. Her educational background includes a master's from San Jose State in physical education and a bachelor's from Chapman College in exercise science with a minor in biology. So she's very well-rounded, and she's good with numbers, so we really appreciate that, and maybe she'll help us with our wellness program. So in engineering, I just wanted to let the board know we'll be having a discussion on this later on in the agenda, but we've been spending an inordinate amount of time finding a solution to the winery issue that we'll discuss later. This includes a lot of time looking through our past, how we came up with our standards, doing some retrospective analysis, as well as trying to work with California Air Resources Board. So more to come on that. So I want to thank Amy and Mary and engineering especially for their hard work. Staff participated in an initial meeting with CAPCOA and the California Air Resources Board to discuss revising criteria pollutant and toxic emissions reporting regulation. The final rule adopted this year applies to larger sources which are required to report greenhouse gas emissions such as oil and gas facilities. CARB intends to update the rule this next year to add reporting requirements for smaller sources such as gas stations and auto body shops. So more bureaucracy, more reporting. So we'll be working with CARB and CAPCOA to provide comments on the rule revisions. And they anticipate that this emissions reporting regulation will take effect or be adopted sometime in summer of 2020. You'll be hearing more about that as we go. And then also, I'm reluctant to let you know this, but looks like we've received many odor complaints in the marina area now, dealing with perceived odors from the landfill or composting activities. We think now, we have one source that shut down. It was a digester that was taking in table scraps and digesting those materials. When they opened the door, it was really smelly, but they're essentially out of business now. But that material now is going, all the traps are going to the outdoor composting facility. And we think that's probably what is causing the problem. And for our directors that are on the County Board of Supervisors, this is under your control. I hate to throw you under the bus, but we have nothing in our rules to help with odor complaints. Most of those operations parameters for controlling odors and doing best management practices reside with the County of Monterey. So if there are emissions or odors coming off those piles, there's not a whole lot you can do except for hopefully increase best management practices. Also, I think the rain probably hasn't helped because that creates more biological activity as things, the piles get wetter. Apparently we had 7 calls last night alone. So that's heating up, no pun intended or pun intended. And then just to let you know, we'll be coming to you probably in February with this, but we've just completed an update to our records retention policy and schedule. And we've spent a lot of time on that, especially Amy and staff again. So you'll get to see the good work we've done and hopefully approve that. In planning and air monitoring, phase 2 of the Monterey Bay Electric Vehicle Incentive Program, which is the incentive to people to lease or purchase new electric and used electric vehicles, is continuing. We've hit the 186 applications received. $153,000 has been obligated, and we've got about $247,000 remaining. And we're about not quite halfway through. So that's it's sort of tracking. We're on probably a 12-month schedule to spend all the funds, which was a total of $400,000. We had a couple of ribbon cutting ceremonies that we attended this past month too. One was December 4th at Sea Cliff State Beach to celebrate the installation of 8 level 2 charging stations. And we sponsored the installation of a $25,000 grant for developing charging infrastructure at state parks within the Monterey Bay area. The project was implemented by the nonprofit organization Adopt a Charger with a grant from the CEC in cooperation with state parks. An Envision Solar EV charge station was also installed. That's the one we installed down at Camp Roberts. That was installed at Natural Bridges State Beach Park as part of this district-sponsored program as well. And this was funded through our AB 2766 program. We had another ribbon cutting on December 10th at the Live Oak School District, which I attended. It was a lot of fun. We drove around in an electric vehicle. Kids sang songs about electric vehicles. And it was really well attended by the public and officials. And this is a new zero-emission school bus that is one of the first in Santa Cruz County. and it was supported through our AB 923 and California's hybrid and zero emission truck and bus voucher incentive program. So all in all, I think the vehicle's around $400,000 or so. It's quiet. What's really impressed me is it's so quiet that they actually play chimes at under 15 miles per hour so school children can hear it. And apparently you can download a music file, and some schools are using their marching band recordings to play as the school bus drives by. So if you're ever worried about getting run over by a marching band, then this would be one of those times. And then Ann mentioned this about new technology. We do like new technology here. We've recently acquired a drone that will assist with our smoke management program. And no, it's not going to be flying around Santa Cruz looking for violators, but we're going to use it to map areas where prescribed burns are going to take place. And then we'll also be using it to take vertical temperature profiles of the atmosphere. And this is huge because right now we use weather balloons. We launch them, they have a little data collector, and then we have to retrieve the balloons and the data. We'll have this all in, we'll have the thing fly up, and we'll be able to check the lapse rate, they call it, the temperature profile, and we can get to a mixing height so we know how high the plume has to go before it starts dispersing. And to my knowledge, this is, although people are talking about this as the future of weather forecasting, I think we're one of the only air districts right now that's been testing this out. I hope to get a publishable paper out of this as well so that we can talk about our experiences with this weather profiling. And it's a pretty nice drone. Our employees have gone to pilot school, and we've got the liability and all that sort of thing. We will not be flying them in the airport air paths, flight paths, because that's an extreme danger, but so is launching balloons. And then lastly, as we sort of close out this year, I just want to give a thanks to our engineering, compliance, planning, and air monitoring teams for outstanding work this year to improve air quality. And I would also like to thank the board for providing leadership, excellent leadership and direction, and wish everybody a happy holiday. And then finally, Amy brought this up to my attention. As we move into this new year, we had talked about back in 2006 with the Global Warming Solutions Act that was signed by Governor Schwarzenegger, we made a promise or had a target of achieving 1990 levels of greenhouse gases in the year 2020. Well, we actually bested that mark by 4 years. We achieved that back in 2016, which is really great, and we're one of the first in the country to do so, to have a program to do that. And we continue to do that, although we're not in charge of regulating CO2 emissions. We are doing a lot with reducing greenhouse emissions with our electric vehicle infrastructure programs and our lease programs, and also with our ancillary role on the Monterey Bay Community Power. I'm really proud that all the emissions in this three-county jurisdiction are essentially carbon-free. So we look forward to working this next year. And once again, thank you very much and happy holidays. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich. Maybe just one comment, and we'll see where it goes. Rich, myself, Director Lopez, and indirectly as well, Director Hurst, some discussion on wineries and a request by the industry locally to deal with ideally an annual VOC maximum as opposed to a daily limit. We've talked about this as a board in the past, and I think the determination was we don't necessarily need an agenda item. We don't need, we'll get to it. But okay. I mean, I want to recognize that much of the work's being done, and I think we have a pathway, and we'll work on that. So Mary and to Amy is very positive. So I also want to the point in Marina, because I think we've talked about this as well. I'm in touch with one council member in Marina. I think maybe a community meeting might be possible or something to look at, because I think that's, how long has that gone on for? Is it at least two?
So here's been going on for many years. More than two. We don't have any mechanism to really pay for this. So, and since we have no way to regulate it, we are looking at adopting some rules going forward for composting facilities that wouldn't address odors in particular, but may get at some of the management practices that could create odors. So we may have a sort of a back-end way of regulating emissions from these types of facilities. But they also have a considerable amount of VOC emissions, too. And that's a concern. That's a public good issue as well. So they, if there are any additional credits to be used, they may be first in line for those.
Why is this finished up here? Director Lopez.
I would just like to add, and we can agendize this for future discussion, but this is a good example of Cal Recycle not really taking into consideration air quality emissions. And so after the fact, we talked to them, but you should have talked to us first. And I'll tell you, regardless, even if you take away the VOC, nobody likes having a composting facility in their backyard because they're stinky. And so good land use is the only way to get around that issue. That means not having a compost facility near any residential daycare, school, or hospital, or anything like that, because they can be really problematic.
It can be. You know, as a former master composter, I can say if they're done right, like, they're not sticky. You could... I do. No shit. All right, any other questions or comments for Rich? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go on to the consent agenda. I understand we're pulling 16A. Is that right, Rich?
That's correct.
Okay, so anybody from the board wish to pull an item? Okay, public? Seeing none. Any comments from the public? Seeing none. We'll come back. We need a motion for the consent agenda, excluding item 16A.
Approval.
Okay.
Second.
Seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. So with that, we'll go ahead and move on to our regular agenda, and it's time to take a look at our annual audit report. Rosa?
Good afternoon. So I have our June 30th draft financials are attached, and you know, we had a net position increase of about $1.7 million, and the majority of that was from our new grant programs, such as the CAP and the Farmer. And we had the Moyer program also had a large increase in funding. We have all the reports are attached, and I have invited Nitesh from Badawi and Associates to do a presentation on the year-end financials.
So I'll go over it pretty quick, but we've completed our audit for the district 2019 financial statements. We issued an unmodified opinion. We didn't identify any material weaknesses or anything that's to be reported. But to go over our slides, our agenda, we'll go over the engagement team who were involved in the audit, deliverables, and scope of the audit. Areas of primary emphasis, we do look at everything, but some things we pay more attention to than others. Our auditor's report, and we'll look at some financial side. We'll go over briefly our required communications that we're required to make to you as the governing body of the district. I'll talk briefly about new accounting standards, and then I'll leave some time for questions and conclude. It seems to be a bit more snappy. So our engagement team, so I was the partner on the audit this year. We did have a quality control reviewer who reviews our work at the end of the audit to make sure we followed all the accounting standards and auditing standards. I had one staff helping me complete the audit. He was doing the boots on the ground, so to speak. We did have access to an IT specialist. We didn't need to bring him involved in the audit because he's normally brought, we normally use him more if you're using, to generate your own software, you're making modifications to your accounting software, which the district doesn't, so we evaluate internal controls over IT ourselves. Our deliverables, so in the big packet that you have, or financial statements, the notes, only two pages are our report as the auditors, and that's the opinion. And we'll be issuing another letter, pretty much just going over the slides here, just communicating our required communications. So we'll be issuing a separate letter for that after we issue our report. Areas of primary emphasis, so there are two, in terms of revenues and receivables, we have to consider the risk of improper revenue recognition. It's nothing necessarily unique to the district's operations that we have to consider that to be a risk. It's a risk that's a general risk for all audits. There is a incentive to overstate revenues to make the financials look better. That's just identified as a risk that we have to assume to be in the financial statements when we audit them. We address that risk by doing testing of your permits, license fees, validating those. We review the allowance for uncollectible amounts, which is minimal for the district because we do collect those timely. We do other analytics, budget to actuals, current year to prior, to see if there are any unusual fluctuations in revenues. Pension and OPEB are relatively new accounting pronouncements, so we do pay attention to those. Those are complex. What we do is we look at actuarial reports, make sure those match what's reported on the financial statements. We look at auditors' opinions issued by CalPERS and PARS. We test census data that goes into calculating those actuarial estimates. And we look at management journal entries to make sure they're appropriate. So going over our auditor's reports, so we issued an unmodified opinion. What that means is that the financial statements are fairly stated in all material respects. The significant accounting policies have been applied correctly, estimates are reasonable, and disclosures are appropriate and complete as needed. One board wasn't happy with the word fairly stated. They felt that we were giving the district an A-, but that's pretty much the language as we are allowed to use as auditors when we're issuing a report. And the reason why we say fairly stated or fairly presented in all material respects is that we don't look at everything. We audit based on a risk-based approach. We use materiality. We sample. So there may be errors in the financial statements. However, those errors should be immaterial, if any. Just going over some financial slides. So apologize, I didn't increase the y-axis there, but you did have a significant increase in cash this year from 17 million to 20 million. That was mainly as a result of receipt of some new significant grants that were sent and also unspent during the year, which if I go over the liabilities, you'll see that there's an increase in other liabilities. That increase in other liabilities is your unearned revenues. Those are grant receipts that were received but are yet to be used. In the case that you decide not to use them, you would be required to pay them back to the grantor by their a liability. Otherwise, no significant trends there. The slide of your net position, nothing significant here. You see that your change in net position increased from prior year, which is a result of some new grant revenues that were spent and recognize as revenue, in addition to, I think, some other increases, general revenues from prior year. On slide number 14, this is just a comparison of your unrestricted fund balance to your annual expenditures, just to give you an idea of if you had in unlikely situation of no further revenues coming in, how long would you be able to operate for? So you have about 7 months of fund balance available to you. And this is unrestricted revenue, so anything that's restricted, that's spent for a specific purpose, wouldn't be included in this calculation. The GFOA recommends about 2 to 4 months, so you're above that in good shape. Slide number 16, just going over some pension information. So as expected and as per usual with other agencies, your annual pension contributions went up from prior year. It seems to be increasing about the same every year. It's expected to go up again next year. Your funded status of the plan remained about the same. Nothing significant there. The net pension liability is about the same as prior year. In the financial statements, there's sensitivity disclosure for pension, pretty much highlighting the significance of the discount rate, an assumption that's used to derive your net pension liability. Had the actuary used a discount rate that was 1% lower or 1% higher, that liability would be half to double what it is currently in the financial statement. So just give you an idea of what that number could be had the actuary used a different discount rate. Going over OPEB, so the distributed had some higher annual OPEB contributions that were made during the year, some of it to the trust, some of them just as retiree medical premiums that were paid. Nothing significant there. Your unfunded liability for OPEB slightly decreased this year, mainly as a result of just putting more money into the trust to offset that liability. So that's going in a good direction. Similarly, you have a sensitivity disclosure for OPEB to give you an idea of the range of what the liability would be had the actuary used the discount rate 1% lower or higher from what was used. So that's not as significant of a change compared to pension, just because when you look at retiree medical premiums compared to someone's pension, the amounts are not as drastic of a as much, but it does increase slightly or decrease slightly depending on what they use. In addition to the discount rate, you also have a sensitive disclosure for healthcare cost trend rate, another assumption that's used to determine your OPEB liability. So the actuary makes an assumption looking at the future, whether healthcare costs will gradually increase or significantly increase. They use historical trends to come up with a number, but just to give you an idea of what that number could be, has that number been slightly different, it gives you a range. So had he expected, or she expected the increase to be lower, you'd have a lower liability. Had they expected the increase to be higher, you'd have a higher liability. With that, I'm going over some, unfortunately, some required communications, not the most exciting, but required to be communicated to you, is just to clarify some of our responsibilities compared to management's responsibilities. It can get blurry, especially when we assist management in putting together the financial statements. Financial statements are management's documents. Our responsibility is solely to opine on those financial statements and to determine whether they're fairly stated in all material respects. In addition, we would look at internal controls, evaluate the tone at the top, evaluate compliance requirements that have a material impact on those financials, and also to communicate with you the audit results and if you identify anything that requires to be communicated, like fraud or other matters. Management are responsible for everything else, so they're responsible for establishing internal controls, preparing the financial statements, or taking ownership of the financial statements, making available to us all information needed, providing us with all copies of minutes, contracts, any new agreements, any other findings that were disclosed by other regulatory agencies. All that information is reportedly communicated to us through the audit. They're responsible to comply with those laws and regulations. If we did identify any findings or misstatements, management is responsible to take corrective action and make those corrections to the financial statements or address internal control deficiencies. Independence, so the reason why we do the audit versus management doing their own audit or someone internally doing an audit is you want those financial fees. You want an independent opinion, a third party perspective. So our responsibility is to maintain independence. So we comply with rules set by the AICPA when it comes to having any type of relationships with management or taking on a management role, preparing journal entries, those types of things we avoid as much as possible. When it comes to us preparing the financial statements, we have to implement safeguards. One of our safeguards is having an independent review of the financial statements. So in addition to management reviewing the financial statements, me preparing them and reviewing them, someone outside the audit team will do another spot check to make sure there's nothing I missed. In terms of timing, so we're here, so the audit was performed timely. We completed the audit in accordance with our engagement letters. There are two new accounting pronouncements that were implemented this year, Statement 83 and 88, none of which applied to the district's financial statements. Statement 83 discusses asset retirement obligations, which are obligations you're required to recognize a liability for in the case you decide to dispose or abandon an asset. Some assets, examples are nuclear treatment plants or sewer treatment plants, where you may be required to do significant cleanup or monitoring that comes with abandoning that asset. So there's no such assets for the district, or there are no plans to dispose any of those types of assets. We did not apply. GASB Statement 88 clarifies some adds more disclosure requirements for debt. Pretty much needs you to segregate public issued debt from privately placed debt. So if you issued bonds, for example, publicly issued bonds, public offerings would be disclosed separately than if you went had the bank buy all the bonds and you only had a private placement with one lender. Some estimates that are in your financial statements that are quite significant, pension and OPEB, obviously, as we discussed, those are significant amounts. Other estimates that are in your financials are allowance for uncollectible amounts for your receivables, which is not that significant, but it's something that is in there. And then also the useful lives of capital assets. So in terms of when you acquire capital assets, how long do you anticipate to use them, how long should they be depreciated, that's an estimate that management comes up with, normally by looking at historical trends as to how long does it take until you acquire an asset to the time it gets abandoned. Normally you should be reviewing those every year. Sometimes you may decide that you're going over those assets more quickly than you initially estimated, so you're actually abandoning those assets or selling them when they still have residual value. But that's something that we review as part of the audit as well. Some disclosures out of all of them that are in the financials, some of the ones to highlight are the first one, which talks about accounting policies and procedures that management uses. And then cash and investments, even though the district doesn't really have complex investments, it is a significant amount. So it just gives you some more information about what comprises those cash investments. Capital assets, shows some capital asset activity, and then pension and OPEB are quite lengthy and significant. They provide a lot of information about actuarial assumptions and other things that are used to determine those estimates. We did not have any difficulties in performing the audit, which we're happy to report. No significant adjustments, and any adjustments we had were recorded by management. No significant exposures or legal matters that were disclosed in the notes that you should be aware of. No disagreements with management. We didn't identify any material weaknesses over internal controls, which are required to communicate. We'll be requesting a representation letter from management, management taking ownership of their responsibilities over the financial statements and also making statements that they provided us with all information we needed to know about, and also whatever they gave us was valid and appropriate. We're not aware of any third-party consultations. Sometimes if we have disagreements, management may decide to get a third opinion or seek, independent opinion from us. We're not aware of any such consultation. Other than the engagement letter, and we'll be providing a management documentation letter, there are no other significant written communications that we've had with management that we should be aware of. There are no material uncertainties or going concerns disclosed in the financials, and we're not aware of any fraud or illegal acts that we need to bring to your attention, or any act at all. Not necessarily that we have to disclose and not disclose any. And this is a list of the new accounting standards coming your way. probably Statement 84, which discusses fiduciary activities, and Statement 87, which discusses lease accounting, would have the most significant impact on the district's financial statements in those years. But we will work with management on implementing this. And with that, I'd like to thank the district for allowing us to provide auditing service and also allowing us to present the audit results today. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions at this time regarding the audit from board members? Any comments? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go to the public. Any questions? All right. So at this point in time, we are looking for a motion to receive the audit.
So moved.
Second. Moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
Okay, so the time has come for a bit of an update on the winery and new source review issues. Rich, you want to kick that off? I know a few of us have met and kind of teed it up, and we'll go from there.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. So I wanted to give you a little bit of background, talk about what the wine industry has requested of the district, and then discuss some of our options or our path forward with respect to how to remedy the situation. The background is there are currently about 80 or so wineries that are in primarily Monterey County. We only regulate about 10 of them. These are the mega wineries, the industrial wineries. They look like industrial oil refineries from the air. They have a lot of emissions, huge emissions. Some of them are major sources, meaning they have over 100 tons per year of volatile organic chemicals, which is primary ethanol. The stuff you drink also escapes in the atmosphere, the old proverbial angel's share. So it's a problem, especially because we're coming into an area now where we're teetering on attainment of the standard for ozone. VOCs are a precursor to ozone. They convert to ozone, and that's when you get into trouble. So back in the old days, this is in the 80s or so, all emission limits were specified in federal limits anyways on daily emission limits. And then you add up 365, and then you get your annual emission limit. So they were sort of interchangeable. This district chose to adopt daily emission limits for volatile organic chemicals at 137 pounds per day. We also decided to limit volatile organic chemical emissions to no more than 10 tons per year. And there's two reasons that we can sort of deduce from that. We had a very, very proactive board that wanted the air quality in this region to be the cleanest in the state. Number two, nobody even imagined that wineries could get this close to these emission limits. They were small wineries back in the day, and they weren't that large. So what's happened now is we have a number of wineries, about seven or eight, that are either pushing up on the daily or the annual emission limit. And our rule currently, which is into the California Air Resources Board for adoption and has been there for the past 3 years, is looking to get updated. We, in the meantime, have had a request from the wineries, and specifically the Monterey County Vintners and Growers Association. And I think the Wine Institute also is involved with this. They would like to see, based on a letter they sent to us, for us to expand our annual emission limit to 25 tons, which is consistent with the state. State law specifies 25 tons. And then to basically remove from the books the daily emission limit. So that means during the growing or the fermenting period, which is during the ozone formation season, they could exceed that 137 per day, but they might not exceed the total amount over the year. So that would allow some of these wineries to actually expand as well. So we think we can accommodate the wineries, but we can't do it unilaterally. We're going to have to ask for permission from the California Air Resources Board. And how we're going to do that is still shaping up, but the way we have see the path forward is that we'll be talking to the Air Resources Board and basically take a hit and say we are going to make our rule less stringent, but we do not see that it's going to impact adversely air quality or attainment of the state or national ambient air quality standards. We think we can demonstrate that with the data that we have, We had similar hearing back in 2003 or so, or six. So it's not unprecedented, but so far we're the only district that has had this type of hearing to make our rules more relaxed. There is a Senate Bill 288, which was adopted in 2002 or 2003, which basically said you cannot backslide. You cannot have any less stringency in your rule without the state making a determination. So we're going to have to go down that route. So we are going to have to change our rule, which will open it up to the public as well as our advisory committee. We'll hold that. And then CARB will probably assign a hearings officer to come down and hear our case. And they'll have to make some findings relative to the fact that it may not be detrimental to air quality or are meeting the standard. I can't prejudge that if they're going to say yes or no. It probably helps that our governor owns a winery. Maybe that has nothing to do with it, but we do want to see businesses thrive here. But this is not directed solely at wineries. This is just any facility that produces VOC emissions, including composters. So this could open the floodgates. We're trying to take a look at that. The final thing I'll say about this is this does not obviate or do away with the requirement in state law that if a facility is going to increase their emissions by 25 pounds per day or more than 25 tons per year, they still have to go through what's called a BACT analysis. And that just means they have to determine whether or not putting controls or not on their equipment is cost effective. And so we can't prejudge that, but we can say now that Santa Barbara has demonstrated, Santa Barbara Air Pollution Control Agency has demonstrated that there is a emission control device that does meet BACT standards that's available for tanks less than 30,000 gallons. They got into an agreement with the Wine Institute that they wouldn't talk about tanks greater than 30,000 gallons. So there's also, in tandem, we know that the Wine Institute is also going to be sponsoring legislation. There's a two-year bill that's probably going to come back to life that seeks to remove the wine industry from any kind of air regulations. I think that's a really heavy lift because it's not only in state law, but it's also in federal law under new source rule provisions. So in short, we would like to get the board's input and direction on moving forward with discussions with the California Air Resources Board on the best way to manage this issue, to ask for a hearing to relax our standards and our rule to accommodate the wine industry's request.
Great, great summary. Questions, thoughts, we'll go to Director Thorpe.
I seem to remember when we talked about this before that our county is putting our wineries at a disadvantage with other wineries. So can you address that where the other, because we're hearing that we're having to ship a lot of our grapes up north and other places, and it's a disincentive to expand our wineries that we all kind of want. So how do we compare with other counties?
Well, so we've done our research too, and we find that the regulation of wineries throughout the state is inconsistent. By that, I do not mean it's not a level playing field. What I mean is there's peaks and valleys. Some regulate to higher levels, some regulate to less. For instance, Santa Barbara has a daily emission limit. That could be more stringent, considered more stringent than ours if we do away with the daily. I would also say that the Bay Area Air Resources District now is looking at regulating severely the wine industry because they've got a real problem with smog up there. So they are now launching in a rulemaking order to regulate wineries at a lower capacity. So the only other area where wine is made is in the Central Valley, and they're made in sometimes huge million-gallon stainless steel tanks. It's a different type of wine. It's not the smaller boutique wines. They have emission limits, which can be considered more stringent than ours, so on an annual basis. So it's all over the map, it's inconsistent, and there's a reason for that, because each local air district has different air quality requirements. They're worse up in the Bay Area, and the San Joaquin's worse than ours. And then the board took the the measured approach to say we want to protect our air better than anybody else back a number of decades ago. So with those in consideration, I would say it's not that they're at disadvantage. You'll hear that, but we have yet to see any evidence or proof that that's actually happened. We know, for instance, that people are not going to Paso Robles because there's a water issue there, and that's really causing a lot of stifling the grape growers. They don't want to go to Monterey or to Santa Barbara because Santa Barbara is severely regulating.
What about Napa and Sonoma?
Napa and Sonoma, we have a lot of boutique wineries. For instance, we do not regulate anything below 1.2 million gallons per year, and they even have a lower threshold up there, so they're not even seeing a lot of wineries in that area. But they're looking at them now because that's a big component of their clean air plan to come into attainment. So I can see a day where they may start looking at that, and we may have to re-look at our rules if we had a lot of new industry move to the area. And I just want to say, too, this does not apply solely to the wineries. It would apply to any other surface coating operation, for instance, gas stations, anything that releases a volatile, and composters, as I've already talked about. So, yeah, I have yet to say, I hear that, you know, people say that they're going elsewhere because they're up against the limit. But, for instance, we talked to one vineyard, Han Vineyards, and they want to keep their levels. They do not want to expand anymore, although some reason it's been getting out. We have that in writing, but we keep on being told that they want to expand, and that's not the case, at least from what they've been telling us. So it's very difficult to get at exactly what's happening.
Okay, I'm sure there's some commentary again that gives direction.
I have a question. Those limits are per winery, or are they in general for the amount of tonnage that the valley produces?
It's per winery. So
part of the problem, Rich, is this, that Constellation is a huge player, and so is Gallo. Gallo now owns 40% of Santa Lucia Highway. Constellation owns, I think, 30 or 40%. So you have two major players that are basically dominating now, which used to be boutique. Paso, for example, has 400 small wineries. So I could have a backyard. I was talking to the gentleman, the owner of Buchanan, on Saturday, and he was telling me he produces 70,000 cases, which for a boutique winery is a lot of wine. But for a major player, anything under 190,000 is really not substantial. So the problem is we're not really comparing apples with apples. We're comparing apples with oranges. So you have a humongous player like Constellation who employs hundreds of people, maybe, I don't know, 500, 600, 700 people. And they're going to opt to leave because they're going to say, if Monterey County is going to charge us, if our airport is going to charge us additional, we're going to be restricted. So I think what we need to do is maybe get an idea from the players who actually is doing what.
So if I may, that's where this information gets out. There's never been a discussion of Constellation. They're a major source. They're well over 100 tons of VOCs. They're not capped. They've been grandfathered. This does not apply to them. They would, if they want to increase their daily limits or increase it substantially, under state law, they would have to demonstrate that they either need or don't need best available control technology. That applies to everybody evenly. So they're good to go as far as we're concerned. They're not one of the wineries. In fact, we understand that they've been purchased, at least the brands have been purchased, and we're trying to get a distinction on what that really means. The winery's not purchased, but the brands have been purchased. They're looking to do an application for a Title V air facility. That's a federal facility permit. And they've been sort of dragging their feet, saying they're being bought. And we know, too, from an article I just read, that the Federal Trade Commission's come in and ruled that they can't sell a certain amount of wine and they can't buy all of Constellation. So the dynamics in business dealings are not solely dealing with air. There's a lot of other considerations at play. And we're not holding, to my knowledge, Constellation's not one of those. We have a few that we've identified that may benefit from us increasing the standard. But as I said, we only regulate about 10 wineries, so it's not all the other small guys. They would not be impacted.
I look forward to actually hearing the rest of it, and maybe give the rest of the data. When are we going to have a meeting? January?
February.
February?
Yeah, just to reiterate, so we did have a working group, if you will, a discussion on this topic, and Rich's move to seek a exemption or a change, I guess you would say, is what we've come up with and we're agreeing with. So, Chris, you may want to elaborate on that.
Yeah,
we can go back and forth.
We can go back and forth. Just want to touch a few of the points that, you know, in looking at the entities that wouldn't be impacted with the list that we had at the meeting. All but one were in my district. And when we looked at the map last time in this meeting and we saw the areas that had issues with income inequality, my entire district. So those are the issues that I'm concerned about. And for me, I don't demonize somebody even for larger than somebody else. The issues that the industry is facing right now, having to deal with the soft market, what happens if smaller people go away. We're dealing with a sale, yes, and Constellation is selling the names, but they're not selling the facilities. I've had a commitment from that company in long conversations that they're not leaving Monterey County. They understand the value that we have here, but they have shared their concern overall about their neighbors as well. There's an expertise that comes, and the reason that we're an exciting place to do business is we have an incredible population here who understands how to grow it, how to produce it, how to move it, and how to label it and get it onto a store shelf. And that's what we have to encourage as a region. And for me, it's about those jobs. It's about those people who go to work every single day. And we need to be competitive in that space. For my communities, there's very few jobs that come year-round, and the wineries are one of those, where you can work there year-round. There's always something to do, and it keeps you occupied. It's indoor work, it's good work, and you know, when you have a larger company, there's stability in the paycheck, and that's important. So these are the things that I'm watching. I understand that in this role, in this capacity, I have to be concerned about the impacts to my community, but when I look at the quality of air in my community, and I look at that trade-off between the social economic justice and the air quality, for me, right now, I'm prioritizing those jobs and the people who live in my community. That's what's important to me. They made that clear to me. That was part of the mandate that put me in the position I'm in now, was bring us jobs. And so when I hear the stories, whether anecdotal or in any other capacity, that folks are not looking at us as the place to expand because of these limits and the way that our policy is structured, I see an opportunity to make us competitive, an opportunity to put us in a position for additional growth, which in my communities is a benefit. I've been there at night, I've harvested this year, I helped harvest over 4 different people's crops, and the majority of those were going on trucks at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning to leave our area. That concerns me. I want those grapes here. And so when I'm there advocating to, you know, those people while we're harvesting and I've got the owner in the field, I'm saying, why aren't we producing it here? We've been fortunate. We drew some people in the last year, like Jay Moore, to bring their facility into Monterey County. But these are real challenges to business. And so I want to level the playing field as much as possible to make sure that we're competitive. I'm not saying slope it or slant it in our direction, but I want to be just as competitive as our neighbors. And, you know, Santa Barbara, even Napa, Sonoma, they've got other opportunities for their communities there with the amount of tourism and hotels that they have in their immediate vicinity. My communities don't have that right now. We're fighting to bring that too, but we don't have that right now. So it's about that opportunity for South County that I want to make sure that we continue to advocate for through this process. And I just wanted to make those comments, and I'm in support of the recommendation coming from the working group to continue to move forward to see how we can address this as a board, and hope that we can do it in a way that is as low impact and quick as possible to put us on that level footing.
Yeah, no, thanks, Chris. I think there were 8 facilities, one of which was Vinegar, 3 of which may be interested, maybe not. It sounds like, obviously, district staff spoken with one of them. You know, whatever the case, the Industry Association of Monterey County has asked for this. There's been discussion, we've gone back and forth. I think I've been a party to 3 different meetings since we last met, and I think staff has the right direction. So we may be visited by a hearing officer from the State Air Resources Board. And, you know, at one point we even thought it might need legislation, and I don't think that would be necessary. So I think, unless anybody's in disagreement, the APCO and to Mary and to Amy and their help, we'll move forward, and maybe we'll have a report next week, or even a hearing if it moves along. I do know there's been some delays at the state level, so we may need various members of this board, should it be a priority, to apply pressure through state legislature, members, and or anybody else we know. Anything else, Rich? Are we good?
You need a formal motion?
No, I don't think we need a motion or any sort of action. I think he's gotten direction. Yeah. What do you think, Wes?
I think it would be good to have a motion, something on the record that authorizes the APCO to proceed.
I'd so move.
Okay, so. Sure. So, all right. So we are looking for a motion to direct the APCO to work with the California Air Resources Board to remedy the daily and annual limit placed on the district, in the 90s, I think it was 1992, so that we are at state attainment and regulatory levels rather than our own.
I suggest you not use the word remedy. I suggest you use the word address.
Strike remedy, replace with address. Thank you. Okay, so I think that's the motion we're looking for. So moved, seconded. Okay.
Just for discussion point, yeah. I can't agree more with Director Lopez. I think he's close to the issue. He knows what it is. We've got some small boutique wineries in Santa Cruz County that aren't probably affected by this, but it's the economics and the workforce and the vibrancy of the local job market system is impacted. So he said it best.
Thank you, Director Hurst. Before we vote, is there any member of the public who would like to comment on this item? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, same sign? Okay, motion carries. Thank you for your help on that. Okay. So we'll move on to our next report needing direction, and that is the EVIP. Rich?
Okay, so thank you. This is item number 19. This is a discussion that I had with Director Coonerty relative to an article that came out in the newspaper that talked about California's contemplating whether or not they should essentially weaponize the vehicle incentive program, specifically the California electric vehicle rebate program, to not include those that are going with the current Trump administration with the new proposed emission standards. There were four vehicle manufacturers that had decided to go along with California, and it's thought that California would want to reward and encourage those manufacturers to participate. So as part of the discussion, I should just say that we are following the California CVRP standards with respect to qualifies as a vehicle manufacturer. So that's changed just recently this last year. Prior years, you could actually get your Model S and get a rebate from California and us. They put a limit of $60,000 on the vehicles this last year, and we went along with that by reference. So our program references those code requirements for vehicle manufacturers. So if California decided to not include Toyota, Fiat, and a few other manufacturers that I got, Chevrolet, they could do so. But that may be a problem for our customers because right now Chevrolet is one of the most popular of vehicles. Fiat's one of the cheapest electric vehicles out there, the Fiat 500e. And Toyota has the perennial Prius, which is a plug-in hybrid that is available. So it may have blowback on the customers relative to their demand. Because it would only bring them to those four manufacturers, which are VW, Ford, Honda, and I always forget the Volkswagen. So I just wanted to tee that up for the board for discussion to see if there's any direction or thoughts or considerations on how we move forward. If we want to go out as a pioneer and test the waters, I would recommend against that because we might defer the wrath of those automobile manufacturers in the form of interstate commerce rights and protections and that sort of thing. I think California has pretty open eyes relative to that, and they've been looking at that closely. But the two problems I see is that there's a legal ramification as well as the precedent establishment. And quite honestly, the idea is to get as many EVs out there as possible. So it doesn't make sense that we would limit that to only these 4 years. But with that, I would you have to continue to work.
Okay. Let's see, is there any member of the board that would like to offer direction? No. Is it a state responsibility?
Yeah, that's what.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted a little discussion on this. We're in a weird position where we have car companies essentially suing us to prevent us from cleaning the air. And then at the same time, we're handing out incentives for people to buy their products. So it puts us and the state in a strange position. I just wanted to get your sense as to where the state might be going. Ideally, this is a short-term thing, and I know the state's also talking about prohibiting the state and counties and cities from purchasing these brands as well. And so it's a way of solve negotiation in the context of the lawsuit. But I just wanted to get your sense.
Yeah, and it's early right now, but Assembly Member Ting is supposedly going to be sponsoring the bill. Is going to do just that. It's going to exclude these manufacturers from participation in fleet vehicle buying from the state, as well as the electric vehicle incentive program. So that still has to be introduced. That was brought up last session, and it looks like it's going to carry over this year. But we would probably most likely just follow the eligibility requirements. It is sort of a difficult situation. I should also say the Trump administration has also unleashed the Department of Justice on California Air Resources Board and the Ford vehicle manufacturers for antitrust violations. So they decided to do a good thing and go with California's vehicle emission standards. California in turn said, well, we'll sort of back off on those for a little bit. But I should also just say, in a global economy, it really is in the best interest of the manufacturer to be competitive, to have a very, very efficient vehicle. And so why these other manufacturers have decided that they want to side with the Trump administration to have less stringent vehicle emission standards doesn't make sense, especially when the Chinese are working on battery technology as well as cleaner engine technology. So. I'll give you a legislative update, and that pops up in there.
Okay. So seeing no other action on that item, we'll move on to item 20 before.
Chair,
we'll take up 16A.
I think you need to call for public comment on that.
Oh, yeah. Why don't we go ahead? Thank you. Is there any member of the public that wishes to comment on item 19? Thank you, Les. Seeing none, we'll move on to item 20.
Good afternoon. I'm here today just to give you a primer on a new rule that we're creating, and we'll be coming to you in February with the rule and all the public comments that we've received. But today we just kind of wanted to give you a heads up of what's coming in February. So we'll be talking about this rule in wineries for sure in February. So I'm just going to give you a background of why we're here, how did we get here, and then kind of what our next steps are. So I just wanted to remind everyone that AB 617 was a bill passed in 2017, and there were sections added to Health and Safety Code, and that required air districts that are non-attainment for one or more pollutants to adopt a BARC schedule, and we had to do that by January 1st, 2019. And so this board adopted that schedule in November 2018, so we met our first deadline. And this is the schedule that was adopted. And so we're in that first row right now where we're working on a steam generator, boiler, and process heater rule. And the schedule that we adopted said that we would adopt that rule by the end of first quarter 2020, which means by March 2020. So we're on track to meet our first target of our schedule. Having the rule come to in February. So the other thing that's a little different about this rule is that the way it was written into health and safety code, it only applies to certain industrial sources. And those were sources that are subject to the cap and trade program. So we actually only have four sources in Monterey, and they're all in Monterey County, that are going to end up being required to comply with this rule. So it's Lhoist, Chevron, Aera, and Eagle Petroleum. So this will be a unique rule that will only be applicable to the units at those four sources. And looking at those four facilities, there's about 40 units that would be applicable to this regulation. And so the rule is going to limit NOx, nitrogens of oxides, and carbon monoxide from steam generators, process heaters, and boilers at those four facilities. So these are just a couple pictures of what that equipment actually looks like. So back in November, we posted public information, staff report, and a draft rule on our website. So we've had that on our website since back in November. And then, as Rich mentioned, we had an advisory committee meeting earlier this month where we provided them with a draft of the rule and took in their comments. And we also received some public comments from one of the facilities. So we will be updating the rule and the staff report based on the comments that we've received. We'll be posting that in January. And then we will be having a public meeting mid-January, and then we'll be bringing this to you in February for adoption. And so that's where we are. And so we'll be taking public comments up until February 7th, just to give people plenty of time to look at the rule and provide comments. So are there any questions?
Thank you for the update. Any questions, friends? Any members of the public? Seeing none, this is just a discussion item, presentation, nothing to act on. Thank you. We actually pulled item 16A from the consent agenda. We don't need a vote, if I'm clear, but an update that Rich is going to comment on. So now we want to put it back on. I'm sorry. Okay. No, but we do want to act on it? Okay, sorry. All right. Potentially. All right, so Rich, would you the update on the extension?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. First of all, I apologize for having to pull this item. There's a couple of reasons. Number one, this was sort of last minute. It was actually put on last Friday, and so I didn't have a lot of time to review it. And then what really I think struck home is the discussion by Mitesh relative to our audit. One of the audits, we didn't have any findings this year, but one of the problems with our financials is that we're taking a lot of grant money and we're not getting it out the door. And so he has to count that as revenue, and it makes it really difficult when you're straddling years. So he wanted to see that and set up a whole new fund tracking system for this type of revenue that doesn't get, it gets encumbered but not spent. And also, as you know, every year it seems that we have about anywhere from $200,000 to $600,000 that we disencumber for grants that, for whatever reason, do not take off from the AB 2766 program. So what you have before you in this agenda item is a request from the Santa Cruz Metropolitan Transit District to extend their contract that they signed back in January 2018. The contract was actually awarded in 2017 as part of our AB 2766 process in September. But this basically paid for a driver to operate an electric vehicle on a number of routes. So the extension in the contract says they can normally come to the board for 180-day extension, and that's pretty perfunctory. Typically that happens. This extension, and that's why I apologize, is actually for two additional years. And mind you, that nothing has been done on this contract since 2018. So that means we will be stranding essentially $200,000 over 4 years. So what I would like to do, recognizing that they do need the money, but also recognizing the district's financial considerations, is that we go ahead and extend this contract for another year, and that would be until December 31st, 2020, not 2021. And I sort of got tripped up with the dates, sort of like when I started work here, you know. It's, so it's actually been 11, not 10 years. So That would be my my recommendation to the board, and I'd be happy to have additional discussion on this issue.
Great, thanks. Glad that's all clear. Any questions from members of the board? Do you have a recommendation? Okay. I understand there is somebody here from Santa Cruz Metro. I don't know if you want to comment, but any member of the public who would love to speak on the item, now would be the time. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Chair and members of the board. My name is Wendy Mungisto. I'm from Santa Cruz Metro, the state and grant analyst. The Metro, our targeted delivery date for this grant is, this pass is February 2020. And so with the delivery of this new vehicle now early around February 2020, so we'll be accepting and testing the bus. And this bus will be deployed in Watsonville area. It's a new route. It's for the Disadvantage Committee of Watsonville. So what happened with this grant is this is a nationwide crisis with regard to electric buses. Our unique position, especially the terrain, the geography of Santa Cruz, has put us in a very difficult situation with regard to electric buses because of the range issue and also steeper climbing capacity. So Proterra has to renew the contract, and they have to come up with a better bus that would address our unique situation. So they told us they're going to deliver the bus February of next year. We already completed, almost completing our charging infrastructure at one of our facilities in downtown. Next year, we'll be building our fast charging infrastructure in Watsonville Transit Center. So until September of 2020, we'll be testing the bus on the new route. So we need additional one more year to operate this bus. So I would like, I kindly ask the board to give us extension to December 2021. And this December 21 is to close out the project, not spend the money. We probably spend the money around, we complete spending the money around September 2021. That's the plan. So I would like to ask the board to consider this extension. So we try to provide that service to our
Thank you. Okay, so we'll come back to the board looking for a motion to, Rich?
I just would also say that, you know, we've had a number, we funded a lot of electric vehicle replacements out there, school buses and transit buses. So, and this is a weird situation because we're not doing infrastructure, we're doing a driver, which is sort of weird. This would be unprecedented for us to hold on to a contract for 4 years, essentially. So, keeping that in mind, I also, and we've communicated this to the transportation district, they have the option of coming back and applying. One of the problems of stranding these funds, if we could be cleaning the air right now if we had a project on board. So we lose those years where we don't apply these public monies to those programs. So I just say that.
Thank you, Mr. Cole.
Well, I don't know what the holdup is. You know, anybody that's been waiting for a bus since 2017, that's kind of a long way, and another year doesn't sound like much, but there's a lot of progress we could make in a year. And so I'm a little concerned here about the time lapse, and maybe we're just supplying the driver, but if there's no bus to drive, what are we doing? Watsonville's tired of waiting. We feel like we've missed the bus. And so to me, the bus deal is starting to smell more like a garbage truck. So I think we should get moving, as they like to say at the RTC. Let's get moving. And let's do that with Metro, too. And if another year is going to make it happen, that's great, but I'm not so sure that we're really on the right track with this bus.
Okay, so we're looking for a motion to extend to December 31 of 2020.
Can I ask a point of clarification again from Metro? So you had stated that the bus would be starting to be tested from February to September of next year. Ostensibly, you'd be incurring costs for a driver during that time because it's not a self-driving bus. So why do you need then the additional year beyond that. Is the $200,000 a cost estimate for 2 years worth of bus driver salary and benefits? Is that for one full
year? So we will start until February or September 2020. We will be testing the bus.
Right.
Now, what we're trying to do is we're trying to model the route, and so it looks like that we don't have the battery capacity is now going to complete the 200 mile range, and so we'll be testing and we'll start fall of next year for full operation.
So you're saying that the costs won't even be incurred until fall of next year?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
I mean, half of this board has served on Metro, you know, and supports obviously Metro. The concern is that, I mean, from our standpoint, you never should have applied for the funding from us in the first place if you didn't have the ability to use it, right? I mean, this is the challenge. I mean, if there was going to be, and that's sort of where we are, right? Because we got an auditor coming in saying that you're carrying this money over and it's looking bad, and we're trying to find a way to sort of meet both of your needs, which is to say, well, we can give you another year and then we can get it off the books. But it's tough for a two-year thing. Do you think that Metro would be amenable for just reapplying next year for ABC? I mean, because that's actually the time of which, if we gave you the money next September, that's actually when it sounds like you could use it in the next cycle, not in the current cycle.
Yeah, but from our recent and more route modeling, it shows that we'll be running two buses, two electric buses for the new bus and the route.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like we probably don't need 2 years. Because of running two buses instead, and it looks like December 2020 would be looks more reasonable, I guess, if you use that 100,000 for two routes.
No, I understand, but I'm saying that it sounds like you don't need the money until September of 2020 to be valid from September of 2020 until September of 2021. And we have a grant cycle for AB 2766 that'll be open again in September of 2020. And so I'm saying, why don't we just disencumber this money, and then we can give it to somebody who can use it now, and then you would apply for the cycle then.
I guess we prefer to have some assurance and sustainability for that route. And so we prefer to have that assurance and sustainability for operating next time.
Well, I mean, I'll take sort of the will of the board, but I mean, I'm happy to support this project in September. I mean, it strikes meaning in the next cycle, because then you would have the assurance, because all of us are going to be sitting here, assuming a couple of us get reelected anyway, that, which is not a guarantee because I see some new faces on this board, but still, I mean, to me, that otherwise, I feel like the money is not being used, by the way, in our county, that it could be used for other projects that haven't been funded. That's just the concern. I think the one-year extension doesn't do them any good, Rich, is what I'm hearing. So it's either a two-year or it's no. And it sounds like the only two options that we have here.
What happens if we close this down to extend? If no
I mean, I'm open either way. I'm open to either just giving them the situation if we were going to give it to them anyway and just dealing with the actuarial issue, or just not and then re-giving it to them when they actually reapply. I mean, I don't really know what would be better, but.
Well, I think there's will to award in the future. Obviously, as we had our audit tonight, it was demonstrated today that presents a problem. The APCO paid about, it sounds like 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, or I think that this is actually, that there's a larger issue here, which is that I feel like every single time we're dealing with jurisdictions that don't have their mud together on this kind of stuff, and maybe there's a different conversation that needs to happen between the air district and these jurisdictions about expectations for, you shouldn't just be applying for something because you think it's something you're going to do. I mean, you should be applying for something that's basically shovel ready. I mean, you should be able to do these things. And which is what we have to do, or we should have greater cost shares from the jurisdiction so there's greater skin in the game or something. But I don't want to send a message to South County that we're not bringing in money, or that it's not going to happen, which is one of the things I'm concerned about, not giving the extension. right? Which is an area that the two of us jointly represent.
Well, let's ask the APCO, can you confirm that we will see the grant application before us by the end of the year so that we could award it and it would fund, you know, the request at the time?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My memory serves correctly. I think we open the project program in March, and then we award in September. And we have a preliminary in August. We give the board an indication of staff selection, so you have a month. And I think part of the issue is that this was probably not the most desirable project to begin with. Typically, funding drivers is a little bit dubious, but this was the best project we had at the time. So I can't say for certain. I mean, the board could also say you can make, give these guys additional consideration next year or the year after, whenever they need it. But it is a very competitive project program. So, you know, if somebody came in with a zero-emission bus that was shovel-ready, if buses can be shovel-ready, we'd rather go with that because it's going to get us immediate reductions, and we're not going to be holding on the money, which gets us in trouble with the auditor, and we're going to be cleaning the air, not just becoming a bank for an agency. And like I said, we've been trying to do this with other entities. I think each one of you have had somebody that has failed to perform for whatever reason, and there are good reasons. I'm not saying this is a made-up reason or anything, but it is a little different with a driver because usually we're talking about equipment or getting charging infrastructure installed. It's very rare that we paid for a driver. So I can go either way. I just thought I'd, in the interest of the agency, that I'd bring this to the board. $200,000 in the grand scheme of $1.2 million typically on an average year. Okay. It's not a huge amount.
Thank you. Lowell.
I want to make it very clear that Watsonville wants the bus. Watsonville wanted the bus last year. Watsonville wants the bus this year. Watsonville would be glad to have the bus next year, but we got to have a bus, and that, of course, requires a driver. So I don't want to lose the allocation or our place in line, even if it takes longer, but I am frustrated by the process, and I think that we should get moving, and, hey, where's the bus? So somebody give me some solution to that.
Well, I think that the only motion here, unfortunately, and I'm going to call Alex and have a conversation about this, but I think the motion is to allow the extension because the board has already made the allocation. We've made this commitment to the community. But I think that there's a disappointment here that should be expressed. And I'll contact I had a conversation with him, but I didn't realize the whole context. Now that I know more of the context, I think that there has to be from applicants, not this is something we want to do. This is something that's going to happen. And I think that's a different, that the board should also take greater ownership in that, even when we just get these applications in. So I'll move to approve the extension for the
two. I'll second. Was it two or was it one?
Mine was one to compromise, but it looks like you can't do it. If I could do a friendly amendment, can I do that?
I was going to make a suggestion. Well,
you're not the 19th board member, but you can say whatever you want, Rich.
My suggestion was going to be maybe caveating the extension on the successful delivery of the bus on the date indicated, which is February. If there's another delay, 3, 4, 5 months on the delivery of the bus, you've got an issue.
You're confident with that. Okay. I will amend my motion to, which is actually for the original recommended actions for a two-year extension with the contingency that the bus be delivered by the end of February 2020.
And that was going to be my recommendation. And was there a second on
that? I'll second that.
Seconded. Okay. Moved and seconded. We went to the public for comment. We have a motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Okay. Motion carries. That brings our business to an end. Happy holidays to everyone. And may your new year be fruitful. We won't see you in January, so we'll see you in February. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't forget your silver boxes.
Oh, hey.
Yes, we thank you very much.
Happy holidays. Thank you.
good work. So thank you. And thank you for the chocolate. I'm sure you have a